Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Youth Critic Podcast on the Youth Critic Network.
Standing on the precipice of something so much bigger than anyone here. But always remember, you are not alone.
I don't think that we met. I'm Sarah.
Niles.
Hi.
Hi.
Nice.
What the fuck is happening?
Run, rabbit, run.
Niles?
Don't come in here.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Youth Critic Podcast. I'm your host, Kale Smith. Joining me this week is David Weiser from Film Assessments, and this week we are going to be talking about, in order, Palm Springs, The Devil All the Time, and The Five Bloods. Starting with Palm Springs, David, what can you tell the people about Palm Springs?
I really, really loved it. It's one of my favorites of the year. I thought it was hilarious. Really heartfelt as well. A great all around rom-com and a really great spin on the like Groundhog Day premise. You know, when it feels like that's kind of been done to death, like they managed to do something new with it.
Right. I think it was only, it was only last year that we got the Happy Death Day 2 or Happy Death Day sequel. And that's been kind of horror, but Groundhog Day. This has kind of been a French, this is kind of now its own genre, the, you know, people stuck in a time loop and they have to figure out how to get out of it. So with Palm Springs, I really liked it a lot, but really to me, the standout was, Kristen, Melody's character. Sarah as a character was probably the biggest, you know, leap. Not saying Andy Samberg wasn't, but I mean, the way that character took ownership immediately and tries to figure it out, but also where that character goes is so interesting. And you're right, it is a very heartfelt story, but it's also very, you know, but it's also kind of, it fits perfectly into the Lonely Islands, kind of what they've been trying to do lately in trying to, you know, give these comedy directors a chance to do like take an interesting premise, explore it kind of the way, take it all the way, explore it all the way through and put comedic actors in there, like Brixby Bear. And you know, taking that premise all the way through and exploring it. And I think Palm Springs, I think you like it a little better than me, because I think Palm Springs, as funny as it can be, I think it's a much better love story than it is a romantic comedy. Mm-hmm. It's a story about two people trapped in a situation kind of like, almost kind of like the Chris Pratt, Jennifer Lawrence movie we got a few years ago, where they're both stuck in a bad situation and they have to figure their way out. Mm-hmm. Palm Springs was, I think it was just okay. I like J.K. Simmons, Roy. Every time he popped up, that was funny.
It's hilarious.
I like the different like time. What you know? I like the different times that I like the different like times. Like Andy Samberg's Niles is like, I'm just going to go and just have random sex with the people in the wedding. And just go nuts with it. And but yeah, so why do you think this, I have to ask, why do you think this genre kind of keeps, we keep kind of going back to this well of people stuck in time loops?
I think there's a lot of interesting aspects to explore about that, like kind of paradox of having to relive the same day. You know, like, I mean, there have been at least this, like Groundhog Day and like Edge of Tomorrow are three that have like explored the concept incredibly well. I don't know. I just feel like it's one of those concepts that's so creative and interesting that even though you're going back to the well, like there's always more.
Absolutely. I think to me, I mean, and we're not going to, I don't think we should spoil it because I feel like people should still check it out if they haven't already. But some of the big surprises in Palm Springs is really nice. Not just in what J.K. Simmons's character is, not just, you know, where it even ends up. But I think it's also, but also I think the what happens to the course of the characters through their relationships. You know, there's this whole, what's so great about the movie is there are all these moments that are like implied, that imply that have happened or implied, you know, relationships, and they get, and they don't get explored a lot, but the characters have, but the actors give such a lived in performance of what that means, what that relationship means to a certain, what that relationship to each other or to that person means, that it feels authentic. And this was and it's even more surprising when you find out this movie was only shot in like a few weeks.
Everything that we are doing is meaningless.
I hope it's not all meaningless.
At least you have each other. Nothing worse than going through this shit alone.
There's a bomb in the cake. Don't worry. I used to be a bomb guy. Stand back!
Oh my God!
It's gonna be a beautiful wedding.
So with that said, do you want to talk more about Palm Springs, or do you want to move on to The Devil All the Time?
Happy birthday, Arlen.
Happy birthday, honey.
Happy birthday to you.
Well, this was your daddy's. Brought back from the war. I figure it's time to pass it on.
The best present I ever got. Thank you.
How and why people from two points on a map without even a straight line between them can be connected is at the heart of our story in Knock 'Em Stiff.
You ever think about how we ended up orphans living in the same house?
I know what my daddy did.
Some people would say it's just dumb luck.
Take pictures. So,
The Devil All the Time.
All right.
Delusions.
Or the devil all the time. Delusions.
Delusions.
I didn't hate this. I didn't hate this movie. I promise. I tweeted about watching the movie last night of just like how miserable it was. And it is a misery filled chore. Like, do you remember, David, when Tenet was coming out, and some of the reviewers said this was a joyless slog.
Yeah.
I think those reviewers should probably owe Nolan an apology and then watch this movie. I mean, this was so joyless. I get the intention behind the movie, but honestly, the only good thing I can think of in this movie are actually the performances and even Bobby P's performance. I think Robert Pattinson, I think, gave the best performance, and it's the one that's even getting, and it's the one that's been mocked. Mm-hmm. So, but yeah, what did you think of The Devil All the Time?
I honestly really liked how dark and kind of messed up it was. Like, I felt like every time it like got darker, you like didn't really see it coming, and then it like took like that turn for the worse, and you're just like, whoa. And it, that just like each time that happened, I was just really hooked into it. I thought the performances, like the whole cast across the board, I thought were pretty great. Especially Tom Holland, Elizabeth Scanlon, she was incredible. And then obviously Robert Pattinson, and you know, everyone. I really just really got sucked into this, and I really liked how twisted it was, to be honest. as terrible as that sounds.
So can I ask, like, what kept you going? Because to me, there is a certain going into mild spoilers a bit, there's a certain thing that happens about 47 minutes of the way through that causes, you know, the Tom Holland character to go from a 9-year-old to essentially a 19-year-old character. So I was kind of wondering what kept you interested in the whole thing, because to me, the movie doesn't really come alive until we get to the Tom Holland segment. Mm-hmm. And that's not to disregard Bill Skarsgård performance or any of the other actors, but I feel to me the problem with this movie is, and maybe it's because I am just sitting in the comfort of my own home, but the problem I have with The Devil All the Time is it's so oppressive and so mean-spirited to the characters that when you finally get to that last 30 minutes where things do finally like connect to each other, because in Devil All the Time, we're kind of following about three or four different plot lines that are kind of, you know, just started out in the first 20 minutes of the movie, and then they don't really connect until the very end of the movie. But for me, I don't know. It was hard to jive with this movie. It felt like I wasn't watching the movie for about 5 years. And by the time it ended, I was like, I kind of laughed when I saw that the original author of the book was also the narrator of the movie. I had a good chuckle on that, I really was so uncomfortable, and I know that was the point, but I was just so like, I want Tom Holland to smile. I need Holland. I need Peter Parker to smile. But yes. So what did you think of Tom Holland's performance?
I thought it was great. I don't want to say it's his best, but it's definitely up there. I thought while the accent, like on a surface level, I don't know. I really liked how he dug into like the headspace of this character and how all this trauma affected him.
For me, what I love about Holland here is that, you know, it is him giving a much more adult-oriented performance. It's an adult-oriented performance, but the casting is perfect because he is very much, Holland is acting like, you know, a strong, tough guy, but you still see Holland's vulnerable side just by looking at him. Mm-hmm. That's what makes the character of Arvin, you know, that's what makes him so, you know, that's what makes it so tragic is that he's basically this guardian angel that's come down. He's basically the allegory of a guardian angel coming down to put these men that are playing God in their place. Mm-hmm. And that's really what the story, and Holland is perfect because you just see, you know, all the death that has surrounded Holland, you know, Arvin as a character, you know, it really, you know, affects him, and it really, you know, it aged him. It aged him in a way that doesn't get really often shown. And I haven't really seen a character that, you know, just like death has aged a kid that much since Steven Spielberg's Empire of the Sun with Christian Bale. Mm-hmm. Honestly. But with that said, we have to talk about Robert Pattinson's performance.
Brilliant.
It is brilliant. Not in a unintentionally laughable way. I know you and I have made jokes about the delusions. But for me, I think Robert Pattinson comes out, you know, coming with a much more realized supporting character. Probably the best realized character in this entire movie. Because there's this whole history with him. There's this whole saga with him. And ultimately, his whole saga is, I'm using my power to basically, to get what I want. I'm using the power of God to, you know, gloat around and care and get whatever I want. He's a very selfish person. And Pattinson plays it so well with such a, you know, a boyish, you know, charismatic look, you know, feel, but it's also, you know, but it's also scary. There are moments in this movie where he is absolutely terrifying. Especially with Eliza Scanlon, which I won't spoil, but with Eliza Scanlon's character, it's scary what happens in the manipulation and how he manipulates her. Mm-hmm. But looking at The Devil All the Time, you know, and seeing what these actors both, you know, Robert Pattinson, Tom Holland, and even to a certain extent, Sebastian Stan, who plays a sheriff in a neighboring town that's kind of like, that's also caught up in some, you know, other drama. And, you know, seeing all these actors that have been in Marvel movies or been playing in the franchise game, you know, it's kind of made me, I don't know if this is the episode to talk about it, but it's kind of made me, because I think everyone is great here. And I think, and I would even argue, even though I don't care for the movie that much, their performances are so much better here than some of their franchise films. Mm. I don't know if you agree, but that's how I feel. Like, and I'm wondering if that's just because Antonio Campos, the director, just gave everyone a little bit more, you know, I don't know if he was just like a better filmmaker or I don't know what was the driving force, but I felt like everyone's performance here was, you know, fantastic all around. I wish the movie just slightly worked better. And I think and it's very unfortunate.
Delusions!
Probably right. My biggest like nitpick with it is I feel like it's a little convenient how interconnected everything happens to be. Like, it's right. Just a little much like, oh, okay. Like, I get that it's a small town, but it seems like a little too convenient that all those characters interweave the way they do.
Well, it's kind of like that novel. This whole movie is, I mean, I know it's based off of a novel, but it feels very novelistic. This whole movie feels novelistic with chapters, with acts, and like, I wonder how close this movie is actually to its source material, because it feels so much like, you know, this is a novel. This is someone telling this story. I mean, to a certain extent, there's a narrator, but, you know, in this movie, it feels like it's novelistic in how it's structured and how it's paced and how it even kind of ends up. Like, it has the trappings of an American novel, if you will, where everything is kind of, you know, when you're reading the novel, you don't realize everything will connect, you know, that quickly. Or it will connect all that too well. Because, you know, when you're reading, there's much more details to, you know, fill in. But I agree here, you know, it happens all too much at the end, because the last 30 minutes is everybody's storyline kind of intervenes. Or conveniently kind of, you know, ties up.
It's more so that it's so many characters that happen to interweave into each other than less so, like, I don't know. It's just so many people that it's like, this happens to fit into this, and they happen to be in the same place. This happened to be in the same diner, and this when this happened. Oh, and like, we're hinting at this other storyline, and then, you know what I'm talking about?
Absolutely. Like, yeah, it's all too convenient. Like, it really is.
Yeah, that's really my main nitpick. Otherwise, like, I felt like it was so effective in creating this very unsettling sense of paranoia, and like, it's just very, it's not entertaining to watch. It's so disturbing, and I thought that aspect was what really hooked me into it. But it was so that really grabbed me.
Yeah, I wish I could have been more into the movie. I don't know if it would have helped if I had seen this in a theater. But honestly, like, I don't know. I couldn't. It was hard for me to get into this than normal before. But I'll go to bat for this movie. It is well shot. And as far as the directing is concerned, I think Antonio Campos does set a mood and a tone that is effective all the way. I mean, I felt genuine dread all the way through.
Mm-hmm.
But because everything is kind of so convenient, and because for such a long time in the movie, it just, the misery kind of drags on.
Mm-hmm.
It became almost soap opera-esque at certain points. But, I mean, what can I say? These are probably all delusions.
Delusions!
Some people were born just so they could be buried.
What I'm about to do, I do because I have to. Not because I want to.
Okay. I know we're kind of skimming around the two movies, but I think... unless you have more to say on The Devil All the Time, do you want to go into Defy of Bloods?
Yeah, let's go.
Black GI, is it fair to serve more than the white Americans that sent you here? Nothing is more confused than to be ordered into a war to die without the faintest idea of what's going on. I dedicate this next record to the soul brothers of the 1st Infantry Divisions. Be safe.
Okay, you go. You go.
Okay, so disclaimer, I haven't watched this since when it was released back in like early June. So my memory isn't like the clearest on it. But I remember absolutely loving this movie, and I know it's going to be tough to rewatch in light of what happened with Chadwick Boseman. But I do want to rewatch it sometime. I think it's another great film from Spike Lee that approaches so much, similarly to Black Klansman, approaches so much relevant subject matter about timely things going on in our world today in both the past and the present, a little bit differently from Black Klansman, where it's all set in like the 70s. But and then like the performances are incredible across the board, especially Delroy Lindo. He hopefully will get an Oscar nomination, and I can see a scenario where if Netflix place their cards right, Chadwick Boseman could get a nomination at the least for supporting actor.
And honestly, I mean, I would also go, well, first of all, disclaimer, I have only seen this movie in the last 24 hours, so my emotions on this movie are still very high, and I do plan on rewatching it. But also what I will say to David's point is, you know, it is, you know, this, what David's talking about with Chadwick Boseman, even on a first time watch, like it's emotionally gut wrenching. It's emotionally gut wrenching, and it doesn't emotionally help. I mean, there's nothing wrong with how they use Chadwick Boseman here, but, you know, how they use, but how Boseman, you know, is integrated in the story. I mean, it's almost like River Phoenix in Stand By Me, where, you know, we're watching Stand By Me now, post River Phoenix's death, and you know what happens, and you find out what happens to, you know, River's character at the end of that movie. You know, that give, you know, it's that kind of gut punch. It's that kind of, you know, how they resolve Boseman's part in this movie. I mean, it's a gut punch. I was truly, you know, in tears, and but to be fair to the whole movie, Chadwick Boseman is like it's not only the best thing about this movie.
Well, I'd say, because, I mean, you have like Spike Lee, his direction. I mean, the cinematography, the other performances, like everything is up to snuff, where I feel like everyone's kind of operating on this, on their A game in regards to everything that they're doing. You know, so I feel like it doesn't feel like there's a lot of shortcomings from any department in particular or anything like that. It's just one of those movies that like everyone's on their A game, you know.
Right. Like it's in, you know, this only came out 2 years after Black Klansman came out. And I mean, Spike Lee has crafted, I think, an even better movie than Black Klansman, honestly. I mean, this movie, not only is it a comment on race relations during the 60s in Vietnam and what it was like at the time, to what these characters were thinking in the Vietnam jungle, you know, fighting for a country that hasn't really given them, you know, proper due yet, and what they set out to do with, you know, with the gold and with, you know, afterwards. So, like, that's really the great starting point, but then this movie becomes, you know, a hangout movie, and then it becomes a treasure hunt movie, and then it becomes basically Rio Bravo at the very end of Howard Hawks' Rio Bravo at the very end of the movie. And then you can kind of look at Clark Peters' character as a, you know, kind of like an homage to Kurosawa films. You can kind of look at this whole movie as like another homage to both Howard Hawks and Kira Kurosawa. I was impressed. And the other thing I wanted to mention is, you're right, the cinematography, you know. So, listeners, to describe the cinematography of The Five Bloods, if you haven't seen it already, it goes from the, and correct me if I'm wrong, David, but it goes from the typical 16:9 aspect ratio, then to 2.35:1, and then it goes, for the flashback sequences, to the an ultra grainy, almost, you know, 8mm style, you know, but in 4:3 ratio. Mm-hmm. And to me, I think that was the interesting, because it was an interesting way of showing it, because it gave Spike's, you know, a way to kind of let the audience know what time we were in the way we even transition through this movie, all throughout the movie. I mean, it's incredible. It's absolutely, it's incredible. I'm saying a lot. David, what do you have any, do you have more to, what do you have to say of for The Five Bloods? What else do you have?
Honestly, I'm kind of struggling to think of anything since it's been a while since I watched it. But yeah, I mean, I totally agree with everything you've said. The aspect ratio change, and I really loved how the Vietnam flashbacks felt like authentic to how it would have been filmed in the time period, and things like that. There were just really nice touches that really kind of is that nice extra icing on the cake, you know?
Absolutely. For me, you know, but also what's great about the movie is, I mean, the main characters, you know, you have Otis, who is kind of getting the band back together. And then you have by Clark Peters, and he's kind of like the, and I'm sorry if I butcher this, the Takashi Shimura character, Kurosawa, you know, fans out there. He's kind of that character that's, you know, reuniting everybody. And then you have, you know, Eddie, who's like the fun, you know, rich loving guy. And then you have Melvin, who is another comedic actor. I mean, it's just, you know, comedic character. I mean, you have all these characters, and then you wonder, you know, throughout the story, what did happen to Norm? You wonder why Paul, played by, you know, brilliantly by Delroy Lindo, why he is so, you know, just shaken by the mere mention of Storm and Norman. You know, what happened to Chadwick Boseman's character? You know, because it's never been set. It never was discussed. It was just, you know, he was KIA. And that's what I really draw into. And I even loved what, you know, the relationship between Paul and his son, David. and where that kind of storyline went. And, you know, it's just incredible. It, you know, I think, David, we need to talk about Delroy Lindo for a second, because we would be doing an injustice if we didn't talk about his character for 5 minutes. About how and how great the Delroy is in this movie. So for me, I don't know if you agree, but I think this is like, this is up, his performance right now is up there for me in top 10 performances, with performances like Robert Shaw in Jaws with Quint. I mean, it's that kind of like dedication and nuance and, you know, total immersion to a character that on paper we probably shouldn't trust, a character we probably shouldn't want to be around, but we're fascinated, and by the end we have so much empathy for him. And even in the end, Delroy kind of gets sort of a, you know, a monologue similar to the Indianapolis speech at the very end. So what can you add to the Delroy Lindo love fest?
Honestly, don't really, like, I don't really know what else to say, like, other than he's amazing. and what you, everything you, I totally agree with everything you just said. And just like that, like you were saying, learning the truth of what happens to Storm and Norman, like, is like, it's just this huge gut punch. You're just, you kind of expect it to be something else, and then when it's revealed what happened, you're just like, oh wow, that explains so much.
Yeah, and it's deeply powerful.
I would compare it to the first time I watched Manchester by the Sea. At first I wasn't like on the wavelength of Casey Affleck's performance. Like, I was kind of like, what's wrong with this guy, you know? And then, like, when it's revealed what happened to his character in the past, then I would say it's very similar experience to that, to my first viewing of Manchester by the Sea, with how I felt towards Casey Affleck's. And then after you learn that, you see the nuance, and you're just really blown away.
I mean, I need to rewatch the movie one more time to fully, like, see if, you know, fill in the gaps of my questions for Delroy Lindo or for Paul's character, Paul. But, I mean, I was so... But to me, you know, his performance and, I mean, just things he does. I mean, you know, and the things that the character does. I mean, this character is a Trump supporter. And even Spike Lee, you know, puts Delroy Lindo, I think he did put Delroy in, you know, one of, like, Trump's, like, you know, campaigns, or rallies, excuse me, you know, and just superimposed him in there. And it's a funny joke, but you see, like, how, you know, this kind of character is very destructive. But, you know, what I mean by you feel empathy for Delroy as a character at the end, it's not just, you know, the reconciliation he seeks, you know, in this journey that gives you the empathy. It's that you see, you know, like what has been taken away, what has been, you know, and who has taken it away from him, and the anger he feels. And then you, the character, you know, or sorry, you, the audience, you're putting your own, you know, you're kind of putting your own, you know, kind of, you know, litmus test towards, you know, what, how you feel, or what you know of, you know, of, you know, people like Paul. And then you see kind of, and then you're supposed to put the pieces together. You know, this is a 2.5 hour movie. But this movie perfectly, you know, much in the same way, you know, the Russo Brothers movies, you know, with Marvel have been, you know, Spike Lee has efficiently figured out a way to tell you the story and to tell and to give you every little bit about each character to where by the end you're rooting for each character to survive. It's incredible. And also he's doing it with not a lot of editing. You know, one of the things I forgot to mention during The Devil All the Time is that there's not, while I do like the direction in that movie, there's not a lot of just like interesting compositions and interesting, you know, editing and, you know, cinematography choices going around. Whereas here, I mean, there's a scene where Stormin Norman kind of rallies the crew after they've all heard that Martin Luther King has died. He's been assassinated. And the way that scene is shot and cut together, you would normally think of it as like a film school project, but because the performances are carrying the simple, you know, reverse shot, you know, way of, you know, and the way even Spike Lee frames it to where Stormin Norman is by himself and then you cut to the other, you know, Bloods, you know, all armed, and you, and then you cut to a wide where he's coming together with his own gun. I mean, it's just like the way Spike Lee is telling this story is on a completely other level than, you know, what we, then, you know, I mean, it's just complete masterwork. I mean, it's just complete masterwork here. Yeah, and Spike is only like 63 and he's still like, you know, communicating these powerful and he's still like creating very powerful moments in film with very few shots in a sequence. It's incredible. It's incredible. Anyway, do you have more to add for the Five Bloods?
Not really.
All right. So with that said, David and I, the show will continue to do, you know, review Netflix movies. If you want to see a Netflix movie, please let me know. If you want us to, you know, talk about it, let's, you know, talk about it. Because for right now, this is all we're getting. So if there was a Netflix craze, I know this weekend alone, there was that, the Haunting of Bly Manor. Is that what it's called?
Yeah.
That was popular this weekend, so we'll probably talk about that sooner than later. Or, you know, we'll talk about it on the show sooner than later. But other than that, David, thank you so much. We went through an entire episode and we did not mention New Mutants. Oh, wait. I don't, for you listeners, I don't think we'll talk about New Mutants for a little while. You'll have to wait just as long as it took to release, for them to release the movie. Anyway, David, do you have a blog?
Yes, I do. It's called Film Assessment, and you can find me stuff there. And then my Twitter is wiser_David.
Okay. You can find me on Twitter at MovieKale. All the links to David's blog and other stuff will be in the description below. David, thank you so much. We will be back soon, listeners, we'll talk about something. We might talk about the trial of the Chicago 7. We might talk about the haunting of Hill House, Mike Flanagan's work. We'll see. Thanks everyone. We'll be back with you next week for something.
illusions!